starring Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's Edward Arnold. Mr. President, at home in the White House, the elected leader of our people, our fellow citizen and neighbor, these are little-known stories of the men who've lived in the White House. Dramatic, exciting events in their lives that you and I rarely hear. True human stories of Mr. President.
In just a moment, you will hear Edward Arnold as Mr. President. But first, may we point out the truth of the saying, history repeats itself. For instance, did you know that there has been a president of the United States who was a general in our army and who was drafted for the presidency? Did you know that there was a president who broke with both regular parties and formed a third party of his own? Did you know that there was a president who promoted a general over the heads of a dozen other officers because the president believed that general was a better commander than his superiors? Yes, these incidents sound familiar to you in the light of your own times, and yet they all happened many years ago. They all have been told in warm human details by Mr. President. Here on this weekly radio program, you listen to those stories and learn of the great men who have made history. Listen now to the story and see if you can name the president whose career this story is about. Now, in just a moment, Edward Arnold. Edward Arnold as Mr. President. Let's visit him in the White House. It is Sunday, and the old mansion is resting quietly after a busy week. We walk through the great doors under the presidential seal, across the foyer, and down the long hall to the president's study.
Oh, hello. Come in and sit down, won't you? You know, there were times while I was in the White House when I was convinced that a president needed three essentials to survive his job. A sense of humor, a strong belief in the power of prayer, and a refuge away from the executive mansion. Frankly, I had the first, I developed the second, and I discovered the third. Later on, of course, I'll tell you which president this really happened to, but meanwhile, you may be able to guess. It was my third year in the White House, and I had become a wartime president a little more than a month after my inauguration. The troubles of a war president were complicated for me by personal clashes among my commanders in the field. Add to this a constant stream of people who felt that only the president could solve their problems, and you will understand why I soon discovered one of the most closely guarded places in Washington as my refuge and hideaway. The room was over at the War Department and was the communication center of our army.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Happy, Major. What's the news?
Good news, sir. There isn't any.
I see. No news is good news?
Yes, sir.
My young friend, that rule always doesn't hold good. A fisherman doesn't consider it good news when he can't get a bite.
Oh, you're very right about that, Mr. President. If you'll excuse me, sir.
Of course, I'll just find my corner as usual. Well, now, Tinker, what is this process you're doing?
Checking the batteries, Mr. President.
I see, mixing the juices, eh? Oh, it's good to sit down in peace and quiet for a few moments.
Did you say peace and quiet here, Mr. President?
Yes, I did, Major. The chatter of your instruments isn't half as wearying as the chatter of certain tongues I could mention. What's on the spike this morning?
Here's a message. Just came in, sir.
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, have a listen. Request you send garrison at Harper's Ferry to raid enemy communications. Develop raid into full attack if possible.
Hooker. Mr. President, Halleck reports only to you. You won't take orders from Hooker.
It's not an order. It's a request. Look here. Look at the map. Why, certainly, it stands out like a sore thumb. Cutting the enemy's line off of supply by a raid from Harper's will stop his advance in its tracks.
Well, you may be right. But I still say that Halleck will refuse to accept an order or suggestion from the man you yourself appointed as Halleck's commander-in-chief. So what can we expect but failure?
Well, Ed, you're almost a regular here these days.
Your example, Mr. President.
Well, it's good to know someone follows the President's example.
Your pardon, Mr. President.
Yes, Tinker.
This just came from Harper's Ferry en route to General Hooker's headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Cannot release garrison for stupid chase. Suggest you detach cavalry units from your present command. Halleck, you call the turn, Ed.
So it seems.
Has this one gone through, Tinker?
Yes, sir. General Hooker has it by now.
What now?
Unless I miss my guess, Hooker will have something to say immediately.
Your own calm must be having its effect on me. Ordinarily, I'd have exploded.
There's not much use in exploding, Ed. There'll be a time to act. Meanwhile, we watch and we wait.
That's it from General Hooker, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Major. Well, this does it, Ed.
So?
Hooker resigns his command.
A lot of people will be relieved, including the enemy, I'm sure.
You assume that I'm accepting his resignation?
Well, aren't you?
Of course I am. This man knows our desperate position, but can't rise above a personal squabble.
McClellan again?
No. I'll not replace one second raider by calling another.
Well, who then?
Major, a message to Fifth Army Corps headquarters. Tell General Meade that he is to assume full command of the United States Army upon receipt of this message. Give him one order. Advance against the enemy as soon as possible.
In just a moment, we'll come back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Today, America is building the largest, best-trained, technically educated peacetime Army and Air Force in its history. And although selective service is now law, the volunteer enlistment program is still being continued. The volunteers mean high morale and efficiency for our armed forces. At the moment, selective service is being used to supply the difference between the number of volunteers and the total authorized strength of the services. That's why many volunteers are needed. Today's Army and Air Force are charged with the essential tasks of carrying out occupation duties in Europe and the Far East, garrisoning our outlying bases, manning the military establishments at home, conducting research developments and experimentation, carrying on the training of new men and replacements. And you can help the volunteer recruiting program by always showing your respect for the man in uniform. As a good citizen, look to the Army or Air Force man with pride. Now, back to Edward Arnold and Mr. President.
Probably guessed by now who the president is in this story. Of course, later on I'll tell you which one it was. It was the 28th of June when General Hooker resigned his command. I appointed General Meade in his place and went home to the White House to pray. I prayed that night and the night following and the one following that. During the day, Ed Stanton and I lived in the telegraph room of the War Department. We waited for the two opposing armies to join battle. And each morning asked Major Eckert to give us a picture of what was happening.
Our forces under Hancock, Sickles, and Reynolds are moving in the direction of Gettysburg, gentlemen, while General Meade himself appears to be in the vicinity of Taneytown. The rest of our forces are as far away as Westminster.
Too scattered, much too scattered.
And the enemy?
General Early's divisions are moving down from York, and the enemy under General Hill advancing along the Chambersburg Road. That's our information to date.
Look at the map, Mr. President. Our right flank can only curve back on itself in a fishhook. Our position is almost untenable already.
It's not too bad, Ed. If we move fast enough to hold the town, or even turn our line here on Cobb's Hill and run it along the ridge here.
Cemetery Ridge, sir.
Oh, is that what they call it?
Yes, sir.
Rather too appropriate for what seems to be shaping up in that vicinity.
Defeat seems to be shaping up.
Oh, give me the chance, Ed. Nothing's lost as yet.
Except position, sir. Except position.
Any word from General Meade, Major?
Not as yet, sir. His regular morning communique should be off the wire shortly, however.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. President.
Yes, Tinker.
This came in just now, sir. Addressed to you from General Meade.
Thank you. Great Caesar's God.
Have we made contact with them, sir?
Made contact? General Meade wires that he will engage the enemy within a reasonable time.
A reasonable time. In 2 weeks, Stuart's cavalry will reach the outskirts of New York and Lee will be in Philadelphia. They're forcing the fight, not us.
Yes, General. Yes, sir. Our General Meade will be ready to fight a magnificent battle when there is no enemy to fight.
No use. Confusion. Utter and absolute confusion. Inside Gettysburg and out.
The fog of war, Ed. It will clear up.
Will it, sir? Buford takes his cavalry into the town. Then word comes that the first corps has fled before Hill's men on the Chambersburg Road. Now we find out they didn't flee, but only retreated strategically. Meanwhile, the enemies in Gettysburg, Buford's division has disappeared and Meade's 15 miles away.
You forget Howard up on Cemetery Hill.
Forget? I never knew he was there. What kind of fighting is this?
Desperate and bloody fighting.
I know that. But once war was fought in an orderly manner, armies moved into position and then attacked. But this, divisions moving up, divisions moving out, artillery on ridges, cavalry coming out of nowhere, a line shaped like a fishhook. Certainly not according to any rules I've ever read.
I think, Ed, that this is the first battle in a new kind of warfare. And I can't help wishing... Can't help wishing just a little that the men who invented it, Generals Lee, Johnston, Longstreet, not to mention Jeb Stuart, well, I can't help but wish they were on our side for a little while.
Is it clear now, Mr. President, what happened up there yesterday?
Well, if you mean, do I understand that we took a fearful lapping, it's very clear, Major.
I'm afraid you're right, sir.
Let me see if I have our position correct as of this moment.
Yes, sir.
Let me see. Our line swings around Culp's Hill to the north and runs roughly north and south along Cemetery Hill across Little Round Top and on to Round Top itself. Before us are a peach orchard, a wheat field, two streams, Willoughby's Run and Devil's Run. Well named, that one. And a stone wall with a sharp right angle that projects well out in front of our line.
Roughly that's it, Mr. President.
Now, the enemy is facing us on Seminary Ridge. His artillery appears to command the valley between, as well as the Emmitsburg Road that runs into that valley. Parallel between the two armies.
Very correct.
Now, it looks to my civilian eye, Major, as if the positions we have assumed are fairly good, defensively speaking.
It seems so, sir. It's always harder to attack uphill.
Let me see now. If I were Lee, what would I do? I might move southward and force us to pull off of Culp's Hill and Cemetery Hill. There's flat country to the south.
Well, if his army is demanding an attack, he might force battle at Culp's Hill. Pour all his power in there.
Or equally, at the Little Round Top down here at the southern end.
That's difficult, but not impossible, sir.
And the only impossible move seems to be a simultaneous attack at both ends of the line.
We could defend ourselves much better in that case, sir, our line being shorter than theirs.
Even my amateur's eye sees that, Major.
Sorry.
Major, I'm seeing something else as well.
Yes, sir?
You're a military man. You hear these telegraph instruments and see the map and the various units marked on it. I'm afraid, Major, that what I see is not the chessboard, but men. And what I'm hearing are the guns and the wounded.
Special message, Mr. President, from General Meade's headquarters.
Let me have it, please. I see. Wright's brigade was through our lines for a while, but we forced him back. Devil's Run is red with blood. And General Sickles is among the wounded. Lost a leg. Estimated casualties just on our side for this day's fighting. 12,000. May I have my hat, Tinker?
Yes, sir. If anything develops before dawn, where shall I reach you, Mr. President?
Oh, at the White House, Major, in my room. I think I know my place tonight. On my knees, asking the Almighty God to give us victory.
The third day, Mr. President, of nothing, absolutely nothing.
Both sides exhausted, then?
I don't know. That's it. Nobody knows. I doubt if the men commanding up there know themselves.
May I see the latest messages, Major?
Yes, sir, right here.
Thank you. Johnson's Confederates driven out of positions captured yesterday. Time was eve, 12:30 a.m., lull in battle, both armies bivouac. Time was eve, 12 noon, enemy artillery preparing bombardment, estimate 120 guns. Unable to bring more than 80 artillery pieces to action against enemy positions due to difficult terrain, top of cemetery ridge. Oh, that's not good, Ed, not good at all. Lee has something special up his sleeve. 120 guns.
Just in, Mr. President. Battle has started again.
Let me see.
Yes, sir. Excuse me, sir. My key again.
Enemy bombardment opened on signal 1 p.m. Casualties high. General Meade retired from headquarters to Powers Hill.
It begins again.
But why? Why all that waste of ammo?
Oh, think a minute, Ed. Think what he said. What we said yesterday.
Well, the fog of war.
That, yes, but something about a new kind of war.
Yes, yes, so?
The enemy, Ed, is now softening our lines. In other words, he's preparing the way for a final effort by sending shellfire ahead of his men.
If we could only match him gun for gun.
We might have, Ed, if our generals had chosen the battleground and not the enemy.
Message, Mr. President.
Yes. Oh, thank you, Tinker. Read it yourself, Ed. It may have been the enemy, but such heroism is rare. Rare indeed.
Incredible. Utterly incredible. But they've been driven back, Mr. President. They never recover from this. Never.
I know, Ed. I know. But let me tell you here now, when the history of our time is written, the place at Gettysburg that will be remembered will be the Bloody Angle and the old stone wall. The name that will be remembered will be a Virginia name. Pickett. And the gallant, tragic courage of his fighting men.
I'm honored to have so distinguished a visitor as the President of the United States.
Not at all, General Sickles. As a matter of fact, I have a very personal motive in calling on you now that they've brought you here to the hospital in Washington. General, can we expect further results from Gettysburg?
We have won a victory, sir.
At considerable cost to you personally, too, and to many thousands of families on both sides. But I'm thinking of the fruits of this victory, sir.
I don't quite follow you.
Well, I'm merely a civilian, General, but it seems to me that if General Meade pressed after the enemy, we might succeed in shortening the war by many, many months.
I understand, Mr. President. Still, I'm afraid I cannot answer your question.
Well, you were there, General.
Unfortunately, only until I was wounded on the second day. I'm in no position to give an opinion.
I understand. Completely, General.
May I ask a question in my turn?
Of course.
Well, you followed the campaign, sir, in the telegraph room, as Mr. Stanton has told me. Were you never anxious about it?
No, I was never anxious.
But things looked rather bad for us for a while.
Very bad, General, but, well, I'll tell you how it was. In the pinch of your campaign up there, when everybody seemed panic-stricken and nobody could tell what was going to happen, I went to my room one day and locked the door, got down on my knees and prayed for victory at Gettysburg. I told the Almighty God this was his war, and our cause was his cause, but that we couldn't stand another Fredericksburg for Chancellorville. And then and there I made a solemn vow to Almighty God that if he would stand by our boys at Gettysburg, I would stand by him. And he did. And I will. You've probably figured out by now who I was when all that happened. It really did happen, you know, and I'll tell you the answer in just a moment. Nothing reflects the spirit of America and the American people better than our music. Music that started when the country started and grew with it. Some of it is grand and courageous, the pioneer theme. Some of it is dreamy and lovely, reminiscent of the South. These are the types of music you hear every Sunday night on Carnegie Hall. Every Sunday evening, Carnegie Hall salutes a different event in American history and plays music that is reminiscent of that period. The well-known conductor, Dr. Frank Black, leads the concert orchestra on the Carnegie Hall broadcasts.
So don't miss this truly thrilling musical event, Carnegie Hall, featuring the music every American loves, when it's heard Sunday evenings over most of these same ABC stations. Now, here again is Edward Arnold.
Of course, you know by now that the president in today's story was Abraham Lincoln. It's interesting to note that Lincoln did spend days and nights in the telegraph room with the War Department during the battles, both in refuge from constant callers and to be as close as he could to the battlefields. And frankly, this great human being had the two real essentials that carried him through our country's greatest crises: a wonderful, deep, heartfelt sense of humor and an unshakable belief in the power of prayer. Come and see me again next week, won't you? I'll have another story for you then that I'm sure you'll enjoy. Goodbye.
Arnold appeared by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of the Technicolor picture The Three Musketeers, starring Lana Turner, Gene Kelly, and June Allison. Mr. President was created by Robert G. Jennings. It was produced and directed by Leonard Reed. This story by Ira Merriam was suggested by incidents in the life of President Abraham Lincoln. Music was composed by Basil Adlam. Be sure to listen again next week when the American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations bring you Edward Arnold with another interesting and factual story of Mr. President. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.